Welcome to The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker in Woods Hole. It's Friday, June 4th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes. We'll speak with CAI's Sam Houghton and CAI's Eve Zuckoff. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times will join us. We'll speak with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle and Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, Noah Azimo at the Vineyard Gazette, and CAI's Catherine Ident and Mike Dean will be talking State House news. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. We are joined at the start by CAI lead reporter Jeanette Barnes. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
And we have CAI's Morning Edition producer and reporter Sam Houghton. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
This week, the Steamship Authority, which provides ferry service to and from the islands, made national headlines. It announced that it had been targeted by a ransomware attack. As of this morning, the ferry service's website continues to be down and no one can make reservations. Jeanette, tell us what's the latest here.
Well, it appears that things are still pretty status quo from the first day of the attack. So the good news is ferries are operating. You can get to the islands, but passengers have to buy their tickets at the terminals. As you said, the website is down. There's no ticketing online or by phone. The Steamship Authority is also asking people to pay with cash if possible, because their ability to process credit cards is limited there at the terminal. On the positive side regarding credit cards, though, Sean Driscoll, who's the spokesman for the Steamship Authority, tells me they don't store credit card information on their system. So this attack should not compromise customers' information.
A couple other positives. One is that it doesn't affect the service of actually driving the boats. It doesn't impact their GPS or anything like that. And the Steamship Authority, sort of to cobble together a response right now, and for the public anyway, is posting its schedules on social media. So if you're looking for a ferry schedule, that's the place to go. I know one question that came up right away was vehicle reservations on the ferries, because those fill up months in advance. That's for peak summer travel. What do we know about those reservations?
So far, the Steamship Authority says it's able to honor all of those prior reservations. So that is a relief for a lot of people. But they're saying if you buy tickets in person, be prepared for some delays at the counter because of the number of people who will need to be there at the counter buying tickets and things like that. And as you said, they are posting their schedules and prices on social media, particularly Twitter, it looks like to me. It's kind of like in lieu of the website. If you need to check a ferry time, you can view those images on Twitter.
So the Steamship Authority hasn't said much about what's happening behind the scenes in terms of what demands the attacker or attackers have made. But you talked to a cybersecurity expert about cases like this. What did you learn?
Yeah, well, demands in the millions of dollars are really not unusual in a situation like this. 2 years ago, when the New Bedford city government was attacked, the demand was the equivalent of $5.3 million worth of Bitcoin. They didn't pay, but Colonial Pipeline, the fuel pipeline operator attacked last month, did pay a multi-million dollar ransom. And the FBI recommends against paying a ransom because they say it encourages more attacks. But it's not an easy decision. And yeah, I spoke to a cybersecurity expert at UMass Dartmouth this week, Lance Fiandella. He's director of the university's cybersecurity center. And he says there can be ethical dilemmas involved in making that choice. Like if it's a medical facility, there could be life or death decisions riding on the locked data. A hospital could face liability for the results of those decisions and so on. And in the pipeline case, of course, the pipeline was actually shut down for 6 days and affected the supply of fuel to the East Coast. So often not an easy choice for the attack victim.
Okay, turning to the COVID-19 pandemic, Jeanette, you reported this week that the community task force on Cape Cod that's been coordinating the response is winding down. They're no longer meeting. Is that right?
Right. Now that the vaccination rates are getting into the 70s and cases are down, this group has stopped scheduling any regular meetings. And they said the weekly telephone press conferences that they've been holding are probably over as well, at least for now. This is a big milestone, I would say, since these COVID press calls started with the county health department back in March of last year.
And really, at the beginning of all of this, those calls were happening every day.
Yes, they were. At first, there was no task force, right? And Sean O'Brien, who's the director of the Barnstable County Department of Health and Environment, was holding phone calls for the media every weekday morning to talk about COVID-19. This was back when no one really knew how bad this pandemic would get. Then by May of last year, the task force was starting to form, and they eventually took over running weekly calls. If listeners may remember, they first used the name Reopening Task Force because one of their
That's
big
right.
thrusts, right, like working, the members of this group are, they're legislators, other community leaders, and members of the business community. And one of their main thrusts at first was to get businesses reopened after the initial shutdown. Then, once more things had opened, they didn't want that name to imply that like businesses hadn't yet reopened. So they changed the name to Cape Cod COVID-19 Response Task Force instead of reopening. And they've done a lot of work since then, publicizing everything that's come out about COVID, about, prevention, about advocate. They've advocated for more testing on the Cape. They've organized vaccine clinics in coordination with the hospitals and with the health department. So now this group is wrapping up after more than a year. It's certainly been a big part of my week each week as a reporter, and it's been a big time commitment, clearly, for the people involved in the task force.
Just this morning, we are reporting that for the first time in a long, long time, there are no towns across the state of Massachusetts in the red zone for COVID-19, which is another indication of how far we've come. Towns across the Cape have been conducting most business online throughout the pandemic, but now, like many other places, they are starting to open up. And Sam, there's no ready-made protocol here. Each town is figuring out its own way to open its town hall. Is that right?
Yeah, Mashpee, Provincetown, Truro, to name just a few, reopened town halls this week and all kind of differently, as you're saying. Yeah, and Truro, they're actually just going to open for 2 days a week, Monday mornings and Friday afternoons. They've been fully remote over the pandemic. Truro is also requiring visitors to wear masks, vaccinated or not. We covered a select board meeting this week, and some members were curious why they were still requiring masks, given that the state does not inside. The health agent, Emily Beebe, says it's about making residents, feel comfortable. They also have a town meeting coming up at the end of the month, and they want to make sure they have a good turnout, and part of that is requiring masks to make, people there feel safe and welcome. Elsewhere on the Cape, Mashpee is requiring visitors to wear masks to town hall, but in Dennis, they actually open next week. They're kind of mirroring the state, basically advising unvaccinated people to wear masks. Provincetown, they opened on Tuesday. They are requiring kind of non-vaccinated residents to wear masks. I think enforcement of that could be interesting. A real hodgepodge here. It's safe to assume that, checking with your town before going to public places makes sense.
Last week was Memorial Day weekend, and we saw some activity not seen in a long time. There was live music indoors, people not wearing masks. Sam, you had the tough reporting gig of going out to observe some live music firsthand. Tell us about this.
Yes, a tough assignment. I went to Grumpy's Pub in Falmouth, my first show indoors in quite a while, and for a lot of other people there too. My rough estimate was about 200 people, not many people wearing masks, if any, really. And Grumpy's, if you haven't been there, it's pretty tight inside, so no social distancing. I got some comments from the band. They're a rock band called The Commonwealth from Falmouth. Also, the bartenders and people, dancing for the first time in a long time. I'd say overall, people were excited, but there was also a little bit of kind of maybe disbelief mixed in there. After a year of not seeing crowds or other people without their face covered, I think the bartender, I talked to him. He'd been waiting, as a bartender, a handful of people here and there during the pandemic. So this is huge and welcome change for him. But still, he said something like, wow, I can't believe we're actually doing this, kind of looking at the crowd of young people, dancing. But and also I wanted to mention, I interviewed the bass player in the band. He said it felt a little emotional for him. He said he teared up for a moment on stage. I think he was kind of hit with some nostalgia there playing in front of the crowd and realizing that, you know, he really missed it. But overall, pretty cool evening. And as I told my mother, I put a lot of faith in the vaccine.
I want to turn to offshore wind news. This week we learned that Mayflower Wind has come to an agreement with an electric transmission company to bring offshore wind power ashore at Brayton Point. How, Jeanette, you've been covering this. How does that affect what they're going to do on Cape Cod? We had heard a lot about cables coming ashore on Cape Cod.
Right. Well, the short answer, it doesn't affect what they're doing on Cape Cod, according to Mayflower Wind. So they have contracts for about 800 megawatts of power from the first group of turbines they're building, and that's still going to be connected to the grid at Falmouth. But Brayton Point in Somerset comes in for future projects because the seabed area that Mayflower Wind has leased from the federal government can support many more turbines than their first project. So that's the situation with Brayton Point.
Harwich, Dennis, and Yarmouth have been working on developing a wastewater treatment plant to be used by all three towns. It's an ambitious plan, and it's intended to save a lot of money, but it seems like it could now be in jeopardy. Sam, you've been reporting on this. What's happening here?
Right. So this agreement was supposed to be finalized last year. The pandemic played a role in the delay, like a lot of things, but there's been some other issues that have kind of contributed as well. So the agreement is called the Dennis Harwich Yarmouth Clean Water Community Partnership. Basically, the three towns want to build one large wastewater treatment plant in Dennis where sewage could be treated from all three towns. But this story kind of shows the complexities of wastewater, you know, coupled with a regional approach. So Yarmouth wants the two other towns to formalize the agreement by the fall, but neither Harwich or Dennis select boards, at least yet, have really committed to bringing an article to town meeting by then. And there are some outstanding questions. In Dennis, water commissioners have been public with their concerns that the treated sewage, and we're talking like 6 million gallons a day could be processed at this facility. The commissioners have concerns about the impact of that discharge on the town's drinking water supply. Whether those concerns are valid or not, the select board will have to show voters how that will be addressed. In Harwich, there's concern about funding. Another sewer project on the other side of town, actually with a partnership with Chatham, that came in way over budget, and that's causing the town to kind of review its wastewater plans on as a whole.
Briefly, I mentioned this has the potential to save the three towns here a lot of money. If they want to go forward, what has to happen here?
Right. So Yarmouth is pressuring the towns to get this done by the fall. And they have some road work starting then that they want to be able to incorporate these sewer plans. But they have to know where the sewer pipes are going to do that. The Yarmouth Select Board actually wrote a letter this week to Dennis and Harwich asking that they work towards that fall commitment. I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. Town officials in all three towns understand the benefit of this. It could save nearly $200 million among the three towns over the next 30 years. But there's a lot of work to be done, and you have to think town meeting warrants are typically due during the summer, so not a lot of time. So we'll see what happens.
Sam Houghton, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jeanette Barnes. Thank you, Jeanette.
Thanks, Steve.
It was another big week for right whales. CAI's Eve Zuckoff joins us with news on this. Last week, Eve, we heard about the big federal report that's attempting to map a future for this endangered species. This week, we saw a new report that says not only is the species dwindling in numbers, it's also getting physically smaller. Explain what's happening here.
Right. So these whales, as you said, they're getting smaller, and not just smaller, thinner, they're getting actually shorter, which is kind of this very strange phenomenon. And the way this began was scientists began noticing that, you know, they were seeing a whale in the field, a North Atlantic right whale out in the water, and they thought, oh, maybe that's 5 years old, 10 years old. And later they were finding out through genetic testing, actually, that it was a 1 or 2 year old whale. I mean, they're significantly shorter. And so this new research paper was able to map out and model a whale born in 1980 will be 3 feet longer than one at full at grown adult size today. And what's so interesting is they found that they think entanglements in fishing gear are driving that change, fishing gear and rope, because the idea is, and you know, as humans, we may even be able to kind of visualize and relate to this. If you are getting rope with heavy gear that's dragging you down while you're swimming, while you're trying to go about your life, while you're trying to repopulate your population, your species, you know, you're not going to have the energy. It's an energy suck on resilience, on repopulation. And I mean, it's a really, really important finding because the species is down to 366 members of the population. And this spells trouble because those entanglements are increasing. They've increased over the last 40 years.
But aren't there other factors that could be contributing to these shrinking right whales?
Yeah, absolutely. These researchers acknowledge that, you know, any number of things, climate change, noise from boats, getting hit by boats, which is also a big problem for them. The fact that their food source has been shifting, those could all absolutely be a piece of the puzzle. But they say, you know, 80% of right whales today bear scars of entanglement. 60% have been entangled more than once. And we've seen right whales become resilient in some ways. We've seen them change and adapt to their shifting food source. We can't fully study how noise affects them, but we can really draw a parallel between a rise in entanglements and shorter whales. Those two things are on track.
We did have some good news, a right whale calf born this week, or reported, sighted. It was probably born earlier, but it's sighted for the first time this week.
That's right. Kind of a very late addition. We usually see right whale calves born, or they're spotted a couple months ago off the calving grounds off Florida and Georgia. But this one was spotted up in the Bay of Fundy, which is even an unusual place now to kind of see these whales, but it was the 18th calf of the season, which is still relatively low for what this species needs to repopulate. You really need to see 20, 30 calves born each year, but 18 is the high since 2013. So this was a really good calving year, relatively. And this calf was born to a mother named Lobster, who's named after these calluses on her head that kind of look like a lobster with its claws sticking out. And so it's a little bit of good news this week.
Let me ask you about another piece of news you covered this week. Last night, a state science board reviewed the machine gun range proposed for Joint Base Cape Cod. This has been a very controversial proposal. It would be built over the drinking water supply for the Upper Cape, and it requires clear cutting 170 acres of land. What happened at last night's meeting?
Right. So the Science Advisory Committee met last night, and that is a group that has no power of approval over this machine gun range project. But what they do is they advise the Environmental Management Commission, and that is a state board made up of environmental leaders that will have final say in approving this project. And so this group of scientists, there were five of them made up of chemists and wildlife experts, they discussed the potential impacts on drinking water and on wildlife. And what they did is kind of an unusual thing. They were expected to vote, do we recommend this project to the environmental leaders to approve it, or do we not? That's what they were supposed to do. But what they did instead is they said, technically, this project meets the environmental performance standards that we're required to evaluate projects by. But those performance standards were written back in 2001, 2002. There have been a few revisions since, but they're just out of date. So there are several things that we can't evaluate, like the loss of trees when it comes to carbon sequestration. Mm-hmm. Carbon is absorbed in trees, and we can't even measure that impact here because these standards are out of date. And so they said, you know, that this project meets the standards, but the standards need to be reviewed and possibly even revised. And the public that was in attendance, they were not very happy with that answer. For the most part, it was overwhelmingly environmentalists who showed up to say, first of all, we're not happy that you decided that before allowing public comment. But also, you asked so many questions. If you, the scientists, have this many questions about the project that you say are unanswered, and that don't really meet your up-to-date version of what's right, then how are we moving forward this way? And it was another disappointing meeting for environmentalists in attendance.
Eve, just about 20 seconds here. What happens next?
Right. So the next thing is a Citizens Advisory Council. They also advise the Environmental Management Commission. That is June 17th. And then the final vote by the Environmental Management Commission is July 12th. And that really comes next. So those are the two big milestones.
That is CAI's environment reporter, Eve Zukoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. One of the sounds of Martha's Vineyard is going to be changing. It's a sound familiar to first responders and to many in the news business. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times has the story for us. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, I've been to your newsroom. I know this sound is a part of the daily background there. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah, so the radio scanners that we're all familiar with that tell us what's happening with police and fire are going silent, the analog ones. This is all part of an upgrade of the communication system on the island, which for years first responders have been talking about the need for police, fire, and others. There are remote parts of the island where previously you'd be lucky to be able to get an emergency signal. And so this is an improvement in the communication system, but at the same time, there are a number of people who really like to listen to scanners and, know firsthand what's going on. For us, it's an important part of our news gathering operation. That's going to require getting a digital scanner. We're told they're anywhere from $500 to $600. Mm. So this went into effect yesterday, on Thursday at around noon. We did a little follow-up story and were there as the Sheriff Bob Ogden, tested the system. And at first, he warned people that the other system was going to be going down, and that was a lot of crackling and the types of things that you're used to hearing. And then they did another test with the new system, and it was clear, our reporter tells us, and there were cheers in the communication center and hugs all around as this long process of putting in this multi-million-dollar system went into effect. So it's sort of a good news, bad news type story. There will still be access, but folks are going to have to come up with some money to replace those old scanners that are we had a picture of ours, and I'm a little embarrassed by it because it has so much dust on it.
Hey, I want to ask you about a cool story that you've got this week. It's kind of meta. It's about a Time story that created an unexpected family reunion.
Yeah, we live in a small world these days with the internet. There's no question about that. And this is about Gilbert Lorenzoni. And the story is he came to us a couple of years ago and did an interview about family history. And that was a great story in and of itself. He has a sizable collection of World War I memorabilia. And it was the 100th anniversary of that war. So we published that story. Of course, it was on our website. And so a family member of his over in France did a Google search, and this story came up, and that particular family member started asking questions about, who is this Gilbert? Does anybody know who he is? And turned out, you know, lots of people in the family didn't know, but there was an uncle who was this like key cog in all of this who did know, and told him who he was. Fast forward to recently, Gilbert had to go to Nice, France on some business, and he heard his name called. And it turned out to be this family member who had seen this story and spotted him on the streets of Nice, France. And they chatted up and figured out that they were related. They both had to speed off to meetings, by the way, so it was sort of a quick thing. And then they were able to get back together again and really reunite. It's just it's a wonderful story, a little complicated to talk about on the radio. However, I would really encourage people to read this. It's just, it's an uplifting story. Right from the very outset, the way Connie writes it about Gilbert peddling his way to the newspaper office to tell this story. And we should say he's 81 years old, so good for him to be out there riding his bicycle.
And some good photos with this. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Enjoy the weekend.
We have gotten some rain lately, but overall the region has been seeing drought conditions for a little while. In Chatham, that's made the discovery of contamination in one of the town's wells even more of an issue. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle is here to catch us up on this story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, the town has decided to shut down this particular well?
Yeah, and like you said, it couldn't have come at a worse time with the area in a level one drought situation and mandatory water restrictions in place in many communities. What happened was the town discovered contamination from PFAS chemicals, as we've seen in other Cape towns, particularly around Barnstable, but this was kind of a surprise. Town officials said all wells were tested back in April, and three of them came back with detectable amounts of PFAS. The level in two of the wells were below the 20 parts per trillion limit that's set in Massachusetts. But one well, which is well five off of Training Field Road, showed contamination of more than 28 parts per trillion. So the town immediately took this well offline. They retested the water, but this sample actually came back with a higher count of more than 40 parts per trillion. And at this point, officials say they just have no idea where this contamination is coming from. As we've seen in other parts of the Cape, cleaning up this PFAS, which is known as like a forever chemical, it gets in the water and it's almost impossible to get it out. It's very complicated. The State Department of Environmental Protection suggested that the town blend the water from well five with clean water from another well to dilute the levels. DPW Director Tom Temple said he didn't like that solution because it would reduce the pumping capacity of the town's wells overall, and that's just at the time, as we said, when they need to really ramp up pumping capacity to meet the summer demand. Another possibility was to ask Harwich to tap into its water system, but Temple said he didn't think that was realistic, considering Harwich is under the same drought conditions that Chatham is. And another option that they're looking at is bringing a well, which is on Indian Hill Road, which has been closed for years because of PCE contamination discovered back in the 90s. That contamination hasn't shown up in recent tests, and more tests are being done now to see if that well can safely be brought back online to sort of boost the town's pumping capacity.
And even with bringing that well online, there are issues with that now, with the things that are in the water, right? Manganese and iron?
Well, the problem with the PFAS is that in order to treat it, you need to remove the manganese and iron that's in the water. We tend to have high levels of those chemicals, of those elements here in Chatham. And actually, a few years ago, the town built a treatment plant to do just that. The problem is that that treatment plant is all the way across town from the training field well. And to get that water to that treatment plant, the town would have to put in a whole new water system to sort of pump it over there. So that's a one of the long-term solutions is to see if, you know, does the town need another manganese and iron treatment facility closer to other wells in town. The select board, they're looking for some firm recommendations from the town staff in the coming weeks. And they're also considering appropriating additional money to bring two new wells that are partially completed on the Harwich line area, in the Harwich town line area, to complete those wells. But that will require another $3 million, and that money hasn't been appropriated yet. So it's possible that there could be a special town meeting in the fall to appropriate that money, since it's too late to get an article into the annual meeting, which is coming up on the 12th.
And in the meantime, water conservation.
The selectmen say that, the select board say they're going to stress the mandatory water restrictions that are in place now, and tell residents that you know, they just have to conserve water at this point, because you know, if we get the warm weather that you know, usually comes in July, and the number of people they're expecting, that's going to really tax the water system, and if that's the case, it could lead to other problems.
That is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Have a great weekend.
You too. Farm visits are a big draw for many people. So how would you like to spend part of the day at a working oyster farm learning how it operates? It's a new business idea that's part of a larger effort to support entrepreneurship on the Cape. Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner is here with the story. Hi, Marianne.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, Marianne, let's start off with this very particular business idea, because it's such a nice way to get into this. Tell us about Michael Chute and what he's proposing here.
So he, he actually wears a lot of hats, including being a firefighter in Truro. But he's an aquaculturist, has studied aquaculture, you know, for many years. But his idea is he has a shellfish grant in Provincetown. It's out near the breakwater in the West End. And his idea is to basically turn his grant into a classroom to have people come out as part of an aqua tourism kind of concept, is to have people come out and basically learn how to, you know, take an oyster from seed to the table. It's his idea.
This is a pretty cool idea, but it's actually part of a larger effort to, as I said, to kind of grow small businesses on the Cape. Tell us about this and how this idea came from that. Yeah.
Right. So the nonprofit E for All Cape Cod, which is Entrepreneurship for All, they had a pitch contest on April 28th. It was a virtual contest, but it was sponsored by, in part, by Provincetown Commons, which is a business incubator type entity in Provincetown. And out of that kind of pitch contest, so there were five ideas that were pitched, and Michael Chute ended up with his company called Silva Shooters. That's the aquaculture company. He ended up winning the pitch contest. There were kind of the top three people, but he won, and he actually got $1,000 to help kind of seed his business idea. This was really the first time that E4All had kind of done this. The pitch contest was called Year Round Provincetown. So actually, I think 103 people kind of listened in to the Zoom presentation. And I mean, it was kind of exciting just to hear people, you know, it's like everybody wants to start a business, but here are actually five people really kind of putting their money where their mouth is.
And And E4ALL's program here, it's a business accelerator program, and this is part of a larger effort to not only grow businesses, but grow businesses that are, you know, startups that are owned by people who might not otherwise get into business, right?
Right, definitely. And I think it does kind of capture that idea of people who want to live out here, you know, year-round. And so that's, you know, definitely part of the interest in it. And I was so, you know, I think everybody, the judges said they were struck by Michael Shute's presentation, that they learned more about oysters in 2 minutes than they had ever learned, you know, at all. And he definitely kind of has a, you know, a way about his presentation that makes you think that he, you know, would be a good teacher. He's, you know, his family for generations has been in fishing in Provincetown. And he's done a lot of hands-on studying. I think he's in the, and he's also, I mentioned this before, but he's like an EMT as well, but he's definitely kind of grounded here in Provincetown. And I think, you know, that's probably the idea in terms of finding people who want to start a new business who are out here or want to be out here.
That is Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker in Woods Hole. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. An Edgartown massage therapist has been sentenced to prison for sexual assault. This is not an easy story. Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette joins us to talk about it. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, the incidents here date from a period from 2014 to 2019. Tell us what we know and a little bit about how this case has been handled.
Yeah, so the massage therapist, his name is Sebastian Padavina. He is the owner and a massage therapist at the Mod Spa in Edgartown, which is located near the Triangle. It's no longer open. As you said, the charges, they date back to 2014, but the case actually stems from an allegation that was brought before the Edgartown police by a spa employee in 2018. And the employee came forward and essentially said that Mr. Padavina had offered her a massage. It went way too far. This is someone who was a professional massage therapist saying that. And she'd also heard previously an assault she believed was occurring by another client, and so he was brought in for questioning by the police. He was arrested, and then once news reports came out in the local papers here about his arrest, I think four other victims ultimately came forward describing similar experiences. And so there were, you know, five official victims in total who testified with the police, and we don't know how many else, really.
And one of these is a rape charge going back to 2014.
Yeah, so one's a rape charge. The rest were indecent assault and battery charges, and there were many of them. And I guess what essentially happened in court was those initial charges were filed, and then as more victims came forward, additional charges, and the cases eventually brought to Superior Court. And then that's where, you know, there was sort of a legal back and forth between Mr. Padavina and the assistant district attorney, and ultimately they reached a plea deal on Tuesday.
Right. So he was originally contesting this. On Tuesday, he came in and essentially said that he was accepting these charges.
Right. Right. And part of the plea deal, so the way the plea deal is working is that he's going to be sentenced to 2.5 years in a house of correction on, I believe it's 6 charges of indecent assault and battery. And then the other indecent assault and battery charges, as well as the rape charge, he's going to serve 3 years probation after the prison sentence. And the conditions of the probation include he's got to forfeit his massage license. He can't work in any similar capacity like yoga teaching. And he's got to pay fines, register as a sex offender, and go to sex offender counseling. So that's kind of how it played out ultimately.
One of the things that caught my eye about the story here is that he's going to be serving his time on the Vineyard.
Yeah, I know. And that was part of the plea deal, too. So the way this works, as I understand, is that the maximum sentence for indecent assault and battery is 2.5 years in a state prison. And then the maximum sentence for rape is 20 years, I think, in a state prison. So he's getting 2.5 years in a house of corrections on the Vineyard, which just reputationally is considered to be a different sort of experience than going to a state prison on the mainland.
And that was because of this plea deal, is what you're saying here.
Plea deal, definitely. And you know, in the courtroom on Tuesday, you heard from the assistant district attorney, who one of the reasons that they were interested in reaching a plea deal was to spare victims a trial. But Mr. Padavina did have a good lawyer. It seemed like the lawyer had a good reputation, and it sounds like worked out. You know, a plea deal, essentially.
And the trial, you were there for this, right? The witnesses spoke by Zoom, which is kind of an indication of how things are going too now.
Yeah, it was. It was kind of an interesting experience. There haven't been a lot of dispositions happening in court, but now that things are opening up with regard to COVID, this is occurring more. But in some ways, it was interesting because Zoom does give an opportunity for a victim to be able to speak in court without having to be physically present with the perpetrator or the defendant in the room as well. You know, not all the victims spoke on Tuesday during the sentencing, but one of them did. And it was a really sort of powerful and moving experience listening to it. And, you know, she sort of compared the feeling of being scared and vulnerable while testifying in an instance like that to the same experience of the sexual assault. And it was just, you know, I think the Zoom factor in some ways, it almost made something like that possible to occur. I don't know if it would have otherwise. Maybe yes, maybe no.
It's Noah Azimo of the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
State House and Senate lawmakers are staring down a couple of deadlines as we head toward the summer season. One is annual, the budget, and the other, what to do with more than $5 billion in federal pandemic relief. And state lawmakers have a host of pandemic-related orders to consider, continuing after the governor's state of emergency expires on June 15th. CAI's Catherine Iden talked about all of this with our State House reporter Mike Dean. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
Massachusetts is receiving more than $5 billion in pandemic relief from the federal government. And we've talked about that before. But what's new this week is that at the state level, there was a little power grab, so to speak, between lawmakers and the governor over what to do with this money and who gets to make that decision.
Exactly. There is a power struggle that's been brewing, like you said. And so essentially what happened was we got $5.3 billion from the American Rescue Plan has come in. Right now it's sitting in a coffer that Governor Baker can dole out as he sees fit. However, what the legislature did this week was they issued a statement and then put a bill through the chambers saying that they were going to put that money into a separate fund and then have an appropriations process so that they could spend it that way after they hear from lawmakers and stakeholders and kind of do their thing, which is a more drawn out process than what Governor Baker was hoping to do. He wants the full authority to spend this money by his own discretion and to do it quickly without having to consult lawmakers to do it. So there is a timing element there. But, you know, the lawmakers are moving this bill forward. Baker says he still wants to work with them. If this bill gets to Baker's desk, he'll likely veto it, meaning that he'll kind of keep the money for a little while. Lawmakers at the federal level are getting involved, saying that they intended for at least some of this money to go out right away and not be subjected to this new legislative move. So the story gets deeper in that Senators Ed Markey, Elizabeth Warren, and Congressman Ayanna Pressley from Boston chimed in saying that, whoa, there's $100 million that needs to go out immediately to four towns that were shortchanged by previous federal funding rounds, and that needs to get out very, very quickly. Lawmakers say that they agree that that's urgent, but they're still not changing their plans to put all of the money into this new fund. Baker says that he's going to try to find a way out of this situation, too. So this is still developing, and it'll probably be a big story next week.
Well, this will be interesting to watch because this federal aid is a lot of money, number one, and it's outside the budget, which lawmakers need to finish up.
Exactly. It's a very big deal, and this is money that isn't part of the normal budget situation. So it's really all relief aid that's kind of up for grabs right now.
So now on to the state budget. The fiscal year starts July 1st, but the House and Senate, in pre-pandemic years at least, have not always met that deadline. They've come up with supplemental budgets as they've worked out the finer details of the yearly budget. What do things look like right now? Are we on track for a budget that might hit closer to that July 1st start date?
Yeah, so far so good. Revenues came in a lot stronger, so the money is there. There's a lot less kind of hemming and hawing about where the money's going to come from. And there were previous rounds of federal funding that helped out this year's budget immensely. And, of course, they're dipping quite a bit into the rainy day fund as the pandemic is still going on, and consider that it's still raining. The governor wanted actually a slight spending cut that was going to come in at about $45 billion. The legislature, though, said, no, we have the funds to go higher. They want to now increase spending by around 3.5-4% to bring it up to $47 billion. That would be a new record high for the Massachusetts budget. Obviously, so much of that goes into things like health care, aid to cities and towns, education funding, you know, the big, big ticket items that we handle every year. But of course, there are some fights here and there over other pieces of policy that are inside of that budget. One big thing you'll be hearing about is the film tax credit. This is something that new Speaker of the House Ron Mariano has been a champion of for years. It gives a tax break to movie and TV productions that film here in Massachusetts. He wants to make that permanent instead of the sunset date that's already set. The Senate, however, wants to include a sunset date, only have that tax break around for the next couple of years until 2027, and make it a lot harder for productions to be eligible for that tax break. So there's going to be a fight over the future of really the film industry in Massachusetts that we're going to see play out throughout this process. It's a big difference between the House and the Senate in their two different budget plans that they have to reconcile at this point.
In other news, lawmakers also have another deadline to work toward, and that's the end of Governor Charlie Baker's state of emergency, which he put in place more than a year ago at the start of the pandemic. That ends June 15th, and there are quite a few pandemic orders and other things that have happened that people would like to keep. This week, lawmakers took specific testimony.
Yes, so this is another thing that's been boiling up that might potentially distract lawmakers from getting that budget done. Because Charlie Baker has decided to end the state of emergency on June 15th, it means that a whole slew of protections and special regulations that were put in place on an emergency basis will also come to an end when that state of emergency comes to an end. So we're talking about things like utility shutoff protections, things that have to do with COVID coverage, reimbursement if spending on medical care for COVID goes beyond your insurance, that protection would not be extended. And one big thing that people are excited about is a lot of those restaurant relief proposals that were put in place, things like the takeout liquor cocktails and protections from high delivery fees would also end. So there are three things that Governor Baker wants to get done. He wants to do that COVID insurance cap plan. He wants to keep that. He wants to make sure that public meetings can be held online and kind of keep that going. And there are a number of other proposals that are kind of shifting around. The lawmakers say that they have a team that's going to put something forward. The House is working on a bill. The Senate took Baker's bill and is going to work on that themselves. And so they say they can get this done before June 15th. However, you know, the governor does have 10 days. If the governor doesn't like what he sees, we will go way beyond this June 15th day, and that'll really, screw up what has happened. So if legislators kind of were serious about having it their way, they would have passed this bill already to avoid this overextension after the deadline. But if Baker wants to play nice, he can just sign it for them. We'll see what he does.
And that's CAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us from Boston, as he does most weeks. Hey, Mike, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
And that is CAI's Catherine Iden speaking with our State House reporter, Mike Dean, there. That's our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Sam Houghton, and Eve Zuckoff. We spoke with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood, the Cape Cod Chronicle, Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, and Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. And we heard from CAI's Catherine Ident and Mike Dean there talking State House news. Thanks to Dan Treidel engineering the program from back in the studio. In the full course meal that is the weekly news roundup, Mr. Treidel's making sure each dish is delivered hot from the kitchen to your ears. All right, that wasn't the best kicker, but we'll try again next week. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.